So I'm reading from Proverbs chapter 15, from verse 13 to 24. A happy heart makes the face cheerful, but heartache crushes the spirit. The discerning heart seeks knowledge, but the mouth of a fool feeds on folly. All the days of the oppressed are wretched, but the cheerful heart has a continual feast. Better a little with the fear of the Lord than great wealth with turmoil. Better a dish of vegetables with love than a fattened calf with hatred. A hot-tempered person stirs up conflict, but the one who is patient calms a quarrel. The way of the sluggard is blocked with thorns, but the path of the upright is a highway. A wise son brings joy to his father, but a foolish man despises his mother. Folly brings joy to the one who has no sense, but whoever has understanding keeps a straight course. Plans fail for lack of counsel, but with many advisers they succeed. A person finds joy in giving an apt reply, and how good is a timely word? The path of life leads upward for the prudent, to keep them from going down to the realm of the dead. So there's a theme running through the Proverbs we've read this morning. You can see it. Happiness in verse 13, cheerfulness in verse 15, joy in verse 20 and 21 and 23. And we see the flip side, heartache in verse 13, wretchedness, verse 15, turmoil in verse 16, hatred and conflict in verses 17 and 18. Now, as with all of Proverbs, these verses don't really set themselves up to be this is the happiness section, where we find a neatly summarised theology of happiness and how to get it. Rather, as you've seen these verses go, there's an ebb and the flow to them. There's different subjects covered at different times. It gives us the chance, as we've looked through these verses and seen some themes of happiness, to reflect and bring on other thoughts that are relevant as well. God's wisdom doesn't compartmentalise life and say, this is what you need to know about happiness, this is what you need to know about work, this is what you need to know about something else. No, we see here, in these verses, life in its complex totality. But I want to make a really obvious statement for my first point this morning. The first point is, it's good for our hearts to be happy. Isn't that pretty straightforward, isn't it? We all want to be happy. Ask someone what they want for themselves, what they want for their children. They want happiness. The American Declaration of Independence says that all people have equal rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Many people see this as absolutely core. It's almost too obvious for me to need to say. But sometimes we get the idea that you have to choose between happiness and being a Christian. That living God's way means saying no to being happy. God's moral standards, we think, are so demanding that it's almost impossible to imagine being holy and being happy. We're going to have to give so much up, aren't we? We won't be able to have all the relationships and experiences, wealth, sexual experiences, leisure, the work that we want, all those things that make us happy, we're going to have to give up because we're going to be slaves to God's holiness. But here, in God's wisdom, God knows that happiness is important for us. Look at verse 13. A happy heart makes the face cheerful, but heartache crushes the spirit. God knows that happiness is not just some sort of emotion inside. We can see it on people's faces. Our moods and our emotions are interwoven with how we feel physically. But look at this verse goes even further. A happy heart makes the face cheerful, but heartache crushes the spirit. Heartache has an internal effect. When Proverbs, in fact, the whole of the Bible, talks about the heart, it means more than just sort of how we're feeling emotionally. Our heart encompasses our thoughts and our will. It's where our plans and our actions come from. One of the key verses in the introduction to Proverbs in chapter 4, verse 23 says, "Above all else, guard your heart, for everything you do flows from it." And so God is saying, it's good for us to be happy. It's not good to have a crushed spirit. Look at verse 14, where God encourages us to have a discerning heart. The heart's not just our emotions, it's broader than that. See, the good news of Jesus is not there to crush us spiritually, to say you can't do this, you can't do what you want, you can't have happiness. On the contrary, God's given us a new heart. It's meant to be a heart of joy. Romans 14, verse 17. The kingdom of God is not a matter of eating and drinking, but of righteousness, peace, and joy in the Holy Spirit. So it's good for our hearts to be happy. And God knows also how unbearable life can be when we're not happy. Verse 15. All the days of the oppressed are wretched. Oppression makes you wretched. And in fact, if the course of your life is so bad that you're constantly oppressed, then all your days are wretched. Now, obviously, you might say the oppressed are those who are unfairly treated, probably people who are poor, who have an enemy, who are not being treated very well. But we can see this affliction of the oppressed more widely. Afflicted by our sickness, our sorrow, oppressed by our guilt. God knows that unhappiness can make our lives unbearable. But in this verse, all the days of the oppressed are wretched, but the cheerful heart has a continual feast. Some people are unbearably oppressed for their whole lives, but others are continually cheerful. What sort of people are those? The ones who are rich, who do not have oppression? Not necessarily. This verse isn't quite so straightforward. It's not a direct opposite. You might think it would say the days of the oppressed are wretched, but the life of the rich is continual joy. It doesn't say that. It says the cheerful heart has a continual feast. Being oppressed does make life hard. We can be crushed by our sorrow. But true happiness, it teaches here, comes from the heart, not from circumstances. A cheerful heart, in fact, is a continual feast. Now, no one can eat a physical continual feast. I remember going to my sister's wedding, and we had, you know, a lot of fun, and we got back late at night, quite tired, and one of my dad's friends, he made a cup of tea and a slice of Marmite toast. He says, this is just what we need after all that eating. Now, I realise not all of you might want Marmite. But certainly what we didn't want is him to say, I'm going to go out and get a curry because you all must be starving. No, we've been eating all day. You can't feast all day. You can't have circumstances around you that are just constant, unalloyed happiness. But the cheerful heart has a continual feast, it says in this verse. Something that goes beyond our circumstances. And we'll come back to think a little bit more about where that comes from. So firstly, it's good for our hearts to be happy. But secondly, happiness can be misleading. There's another feast in verses 16 and 17. Let me read them to you. Better a little with the fear of the Lord than great wealth with turmoil. Better a dish of vegetables with love than a fattened calf with hatred. You can see there are the wealthy people sitting down to a massive banquet. They have a fattened calf. It's the delicious meal of its day. As long as you're not a vegetarian, think tender steaks. This is what they're feasting on. But it's not just that they're having nice food. Do you remember when the prodigal son returned? They then had the fattened calf as a special meal to celebrate him coming back. It's a special occasion. This is a meal with special meaning. I don't know, somebody's birthday, a special event. This has more than just the being nice food on the table. But it says in these verses, you'd be better off sitting in your bedsit than having great wealth. You'd be better off sat there with an out-of-date packet of vegetable soup than you would be going to this banquet with a fatted calf, this amazing celebration. And why is that? Because there's turmoil and hatred there. The setting might be grand, but it's utterly unbearable. Think of Elkanah's family feast in 1 Samuel chapter 1. Do you remember he gave his wife, Hannah, a double portion? Anyone here fancy a double portion for dinner? But was she happy about that? No. She was distraught. In fact, she couldn't eat any of it. Because at that feast, she knew she couldn't have children. And Elkanah's other wife was constantly needling her about it. You see, the thing that we might think would bring happiness, for example, being rich and having a feast, is not where happiness is truly found. We only need to look at the troubles of successful people to see that. Here's an interesting quote from Jim Carrey, who apparently said, "I think everyone should get rich and famous and do everything they ever dreamed of so they can see it's not the answer." This fallen world is ultimately not a happiness-giving place. There is oppression and poverty and heartache and turmoil and hatred, and that's just from these few verses. And even the measure of happiness that we're able to find here will end one day. And for people who've got no eternal hope, this puts a real pressure on them. Maybe it sometimes puts a pressure on us, because we feel as though the only chance to have happiness is today. And if we have a day without happiness, it's a day wasted. And if we were on holiday, we were hoping to do something, and it rained, so we weren't able to, something's been permanently lost of our happiness. In verse 16, it's the fear of the Lord that's contrasted with turmoil. Just as in verse 17, love is contrasted with hatred. You see, real peace comes from a relationship with God. We can have a little and the fear of the Lord, and therefore we know that he's in control. We can have joy because God is on our side. Even if we've given up the things that are supposed to bring happiness, even if we've just got our vegetables, and next door they're having a great feast. Wealth with turmoil. Well, it's the opposite, isn't it? Of godliness with contentment, which Paul tells us in 1 Timothy 6, is great gain. And this is where we need a discerning heart, verse 14. The discerning heart seeks knowledge, but the mouth of a fool feeds on folly. While we're on the subject of feasting, there's another feast that we sometimes like to help ourselves to, and we need to avoid it. That is feasting on foolishness. Rather than being discerning about what we should chase after in this life, about what makes us happy, we sometimes stick our heads straight in and hoover it all up. Anyone can tell me that they know love is better than money, just as this verse says. But still, sometimes we make decisions as if it was the other way round. Just as sometimes we get the idea that being a Christian means we have to give up happiness. Sometimes we get the idea that if we really want to find happiness in this world, we're not really going to find it with God. We're going to have to go after what seems good to us in this world. And so that's why these two better than proverbs in verse 16 and 17 are so useful. Because it's not always obvious to us that it's better to know the Lord than to have great wealth. It's not always obvious to us even that love is better than hatred. And sometimes we have to make a choice. We need a discerning heart. Verse 21 goes even deeper because it tells us that our happiness can't be trusted. Folly brings joy to one who has no sense. So we can think of a straightforward example. You might think of the thief who gets joy from what they've done. They've got absolutely no sense, but they've broken into someone's house, nicked some stuff, and look, they've got away with it, the thrill of the crime, and they've got some money. If they'd have stayed on the straight path, though, they wouldn't be in prison. It's fairly obvious. They've got this initial joy, but they were senseless. They didn't think. If they'd have applied that amount of ingenuity to getting a job, they'd be in a much better position. It's pretty obvious. But it's not just criminals who behave like this. People don't like Christian morality because it stops them following the way that they instinctively believe will bring them happiness. We shouldn't be naive. Foolish behaviour really does bring joy to people. If you have a rival at work or in your friendship group, maybe you can undermine them sufficiently that they leave, and it will bring you joy and peace. Maybe you tell low-level lies, and everyone else is doing it, so even if you get caught out every now and again, it's kind of accepted. It makes your life much easier, because you don't have to admit to stuff. Maybe you just don't think too hard about being generous, giving away your money, and your savings build up, and you have a better lifestyle and more security. You can actually find joy in doing something senseless. Maybe you're not getting the happiness that you deserve from your marriage. Maybe you'd be better off somewhere else. We can feel the temptation of that, can't we? The pull of it, the temptation to make life easier and happier for ourselves, even though we're rejecting God's ways. We can only resist if we know in our hearts that the straight course is better, that we have understanding, a discerning heart from verse 14. And so in verse 21, whoever has understanding keeps a straight course. Sometimes we try to get happy, but it makes us more stressed. Our culture promises happiness. Everyone else seems to have it. And our circumstances make us disillusioned. They're all getting happiness from their folly. Think about how you look at your life. How do you see the kind of key things you're aiming for? Is your goal to pursue happiness above everything? But there's an encouragement here for us, isn't there? For those whose hearts have been changed by Jesus and are resisting that pull, be encouraged. If you're living for Jesus, you're not giving up anything that's truly valuable. Even though it might feel like it, even though happiness can be so deceptive, even if everyone else tells you that you're missing out, if you have understanding, you're on the right path. So happiness can be deceptive. And thirdly, it's the wise path that ultimately leads to happiness. Looking mainly here at verses 19 to 24. And these verses come back to one of the key themes of Proverbs. There are two choices in life, two paths you can take. Look at verse 19, talks about the way of the sluggard and the path of the upright. Verse 21 talks about keeping a straight course. Verse 24 talks about the path of life. There's two choices in life, two paths to take. That's the way that the book of Proverbs is introduced in chapters 1 to 9. And most of the verses we've been reading are set out as these opposites. This or that. You can either live wisely or foolishly. And Proverbs is telling us, God is telling us, that we need to choose the wise path, the right path, because it's actually the better way. Because God's the one who's created this world, the wise way in life is to follow him, to fear the Lord. That's the way that's going to be successful, because that's how he's made it. He's in charge. The foolish path is wicked and destructive of your own life, let alone other people's. Verse 19 is typical. There are two paths. The path of the sluggard. It's the easier path. The sluggard's lazy. Tries to live without any effort or any hard work. Do you know, a life of pure leisure, that might be the recipe for happiness, mightn't it? I think our culture encourages us to do that. But rather than making life easier, it actually makes it harder. The way of the sluggard is blocked by thorns. And so the easiest route isn't to pursue happiness and leisure and folly, but to pursue God, to go after righteousness. That path is described as a highway. When we were driving through Ireland on our way to the ferry back from our holiday, it was quite frustrating. It was a very long journey on some quite small roads, and the worst things in front of us were the hire cars. Brand new, fast cars, driven very slowly, right at the edge of the white lines by tourists who weren't used to driving on the left. And just when you finally had a chance to overtake, you go round a corner and there's another one. But there were a few bits where you get the dual carriageway opens up. It's such a relief. There's nothing to stop you from progressing. It's more relaxing. You just smoothly coast along. The path of the upright is a highway. The life of righteousness is a much better way to live. A way that's guaranteed to be successful, not on the world's terms, but on God's assessment. It's the straight way in verse 21. Without crookedness, without evil, the way of righteousness and goodness, consistent with God's character, just right, just right for how he's made us. It's the way that has freedom from guilt, the way of the easy yoke, the way where nothing can separate us from God's love, the way of purpose. Keep going on that way. God will make your path straight, not painless, but close to him. It's the way of discernment, not to plough your face into a feast of foolishness without first choosing the better way. So joy comes on the right path. And on that right path, joy comes in the community of God's people. Verses 20 and 22 and 23 all bring out this joy that comes between us. So verse 20, the wise son brings joy to his father. Absolutely key catchphrase verse in Proverbs. The very first verse of the individual Proverbs in chapter 10, verse 1. The introduction to the whole book in chapter 1, verse 8. Listen, son, to your father's instruction and do not forsake your mother's teaching. There's joy in following the Father's teaching here. Now, some of us have parents who taught us the gospel. And we know the joy of following in their footsteps. We know the joy it brings to them that we're doing so. Maybe it feels as though following Jesus would give up our happiness. So let's just stop and think. Why is it that our parents' greatest joy will be for us to follow Christ? We can understand the Father here more broadly, I think, as well. Anyone who's teaching us the word. Why is it that my greatest joy from speaking to you today would be that you follow Christ? Why is it that those people that you know in the church who are encouraging you and teaching you, why is it that we meet to pray together every week for people to come to know the Lord? Well, it's because we know the joy of following Christ. We found his joy and we want that above anything else for you. This verse highlights the happiness we can find together, listening to and responding to what we hear. And similarly in verses 22 and 23, success comes with advice. Joy comes from just the right word at the right time. When we encourage someone else, it's a great joy. We're so happy when we can influence other people to follow Christ. And there's nothing like the joy of speaking to people who don't know Jesus and for them to receive it themselves gladly. Our lives are meaningful to one another. Our joy in the Lord comes together. And most importantly, our joy comes in eternal life in verse 24. In verse 24, we can see, in a way that doesn't happen always in Proverbs, but there are these glimpses of where we're going. Whatever happiness this world offers apart from God, it will lead to death. Sometimes it's easy to see when we take the wrong road and the path is full of thorns. Sometimes it's longer before that's found wanting. The pursuit of this world's happiness is not just covered with thorns, but it's a road that leads downwards to the realm of the dead, where death rules. But the path of wisdom, the path of God, that is the path of life, the path that goes upwards to God. Do you remember we learnt Psalm 16 verse 11 with the young people? You make known to me the path of life. You'll fill me with joy in your presence, with eternal pleasures at your right hand. This is where the real joy that in the heart comes from. This is where the cheerful heart that has a continual feast is with God in glory forever. This is the path where joy will be fulfilled. Our longing for happiness will not prove to be an illusion, will not prove to fail, but will come true. We'll know no more sorrow or pain in his eternal kingdom, but be filled with joy in his presence. And it's not just the destination, but it's the road. It's the straight highway, the path leading upwards. The road itself is a joy, not just the destination. After all, Jesus said he came that we might have life and have it to the full in John 10, verse 10, even now. And so how are we to square the happiness of the path of life with our turbulent experience, where we have to live knowing that the fear of the Lord is better than wealth or feasting, but we still see the pain of poverty or not being involved. We know the crushing heartache, the wretchedness of being oppressed. That's where we come to that better than. Better a little with the fear of the Lord. That's why I read the passage earlier from 2 Corinthians chapter 4. This is Paul's better than in 2 Corinthians 4, verse 16. We don't lose heart. Though outwardly we are wasting away, yet inwardly we are being renewed day by day. For our light and momentary troubles are achieving for us an eternal glory that far outweighs them all. So we fix our eyes not on what is seen, but on what is unseen. Since what is seen is temporary, but what is unseen is eternal. Fixing his eyes on the glory and the joy to come means he doesn't lose heart, means he's being inwardly renewed day by day. And that's the foundation on which we can find real biblical happiness. It does involve hope and patience and waiting. We don't receive it in its fulfillment yet, but this is the hope, the foundation of the cheerful heart, the discerning heart that knows nothing can destroy the spirit of those God has called in Jesus. So don't chase after the empty happiness of this world. And don't lose heart as you feel crushed by many troubles. Instead, join this continual feast, better a little with the fear of the Lord. Put your hope in Jesus, the one who knew what it was to live through pain and oppression and heartache. But he was on the path of life, the path that gives us life and that we can follow. Don't pursue the illusion of happiness, but pursue the reality of Jesus Christ. Let's pray together.